here with a fresh start. If you're stuck, feeling overwhelmed, or feeling out of balance, then keep listening to this show. I call it Fresh Start because we help by giving you the tips and the tools and resources to empower yourself to make positive changes in your one step at a time. Usually on the third Wednesday of every month, my husband Conway and I do a show called Light End of the Tunnel. This has to do with self-confidence, depression, whatever is in that realm. And today I have back a wonderful guest, and Rick Hansen. He has written the book Buddha's Brain. He's a neuropsychologist and a meditation teacher, and is a weekly contributor to psychologytoday.com. He's also written the bestseller Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. Rick, welcome. I'm really looking forward to this conversation today. I think everybody needs to know why it is those negative comments stick to us like Velcro, and all of those positive comments fall off like Teflon.
Right. Well, it's great to be here with Allie. You want me to dive in and talk a bit about that?
I do. I want to know
you just
why
raised about,
is that?
Negativity.
Yeah. Why
yeah.
is that? Yeah.
It's a great question. The short answer is that we evolved what scientists call a negativity bias in the brain. In other words, if you think about it, to survive, organisms, mates, early cavemen, cavewomen, had to both get carrots and avoid sticks. On the other hand, if you miss a carrot today, you'll have a chance at one tomorrow. If you fail to avoid a stick today, whap, no more carrots forever. So even though positive events for most people are much more common than negative ones really have more urgency and impact in terms of survival. So Mother Nature wants us to have a brain that's continually scanning for threats, looking for bad news, and then when it finds it, to super zero in on the bad news, fast-track that information to memory stores, and then retrieve that bad news, including our massive reactions to it, at the whiff of anything later in life that remotely resembles that original bad news. The result is that, for example, if 20 things happen in a day with somebody, you know, let's say you're in a relationship with someone or you have a coworker, 20 things happen, 10 are mildly pleasant, 9 are neutral, 1 is mildly unpleasant. What's the one thing you think about as you fall asleep that night, right? It's that one snarky little comment. It's the one thing you wish you'd said. It's the one weird vibe you got. It's the one way you were kind of dismissed in the meeting. That's what you think about. And the reason that positive experiences have plain vanilla memory systems, ordinary memory systems. And an ordinary memory system, as people know and every school teacher knows, you have to really hold information in awareness for 10, 20, 30 seconds in a row unless it's really intense or really novel. Otherwise, it does not transfer to long-term storage. Now, how many of us, if we're having positive experiences, relish them for 20 seconds in a row? No. We usually feel it for a few seconds. If we feel it at all, then it's on to the next thing. The problem is that does not give that information time to transfer to short-term memory buffers to long-term storage. The net effect, bottom line it, is that positive experiences flow through the brain, therefore, like water through a sieve, but negative ones are caught every time. That's why the brain's default is to be like the Velcro for the negative and Teflon for the positive. And then you have individual variations on that based on temperament, life experiences, and so forth. To defeat the negativity bias of the brain, that's why I think it's so important,
me,
and I wrote
let
about
me ask you
to
this.
Take in the good.
Let me ask you this.
Correct. Yeah.
Let me ask you this. With negativity, how in the world does someone practice positive psychology or happiness? Because your book says the practical neuroscience of happiness, love, and with happiness,
right.
One needs to be self-confident. One needs mm-hmm. to be able to say, you know what, I can do this. But what happens, especially, and Conway will chime in on this, what happens when someone is depressed, they're feeling overwhelmed, frustrated, and they're losing that self-confidence? How do you get back up from the bootstrap? How do you do that?
How do you mm-hmm. break the chain of thought?
Oh, sure. Great question, right? Good question. Well, first of all, it is very hopeful. In other words, there's a lot that people can do. That's the really good news. And that's what my book's all about. In other words, I guess I have a business background, plus I've been a therapist forever. So I think you've got to start by facing the challenge. You know, if you're not grounded in dealing with the challenge, you're not going to succeed in business. You're not going to succeed in healthcare. You're not going to succeed in life. Okay, so you've got to face the bad news. So the bad news is that we do have this negativity bias that's great for survival, for quality of life. Okay, how do we defeat it? I think there are a number of ways to do it that people can do in everyday life, and I'm really glad we're going to talk about practical things, you know, in this show. One example is to deliberately trick the brain to 10 positive experiences by just relishing them, you know, 15 seconds or so at a time, a half dozen times a day. That's it. I write about that in the fourth chapter of my book. Just being with it and enjoying it and kind of marinating in usually small and mild but still real positive experiences will weave those positive experiences into the fabric of your brain and therefore your life. That would be one example.
How does the brain change in that regard?
Yeah, great question.
Interjection on that would be, Rick, you have to do it annually. In other words, if you're going
to
initially you have to work on and do it manually with the ultimate goal, possibly, that it becomes automatic. But you certainly have to consciously do it to take that first step.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, Conway. And I like your distinction between doing it manually and then it becomes more and more automatic. I think that's really true. It's like learning any new thing. It may sound kind of woo-woo, but it really is like learning how to use, I don't know, chopsticks, ride a bike. At first, you have to really think about it, but then it becomes second nature. So to Sally's question, you're right, Sally. This is a great question, and that's been cutting-edge news in science these days, how the brain changes based on what we experience. And the idea here, fancy phrase alert, is that there is something called experience-dependent neuroplasticity, whereby what we think about, what we feel, where we put our attention, you know, whether we ruminate on our failures or how we've been wronged by other people, or whether we think about things that we're grateful for, etc. In other words, how does that actually leave changes in brain structure behind? And the evidence is that it does in typically 10 small ways, you know, every week, and sometimes a handful of really big ones. For example, London taxicab drivers, I love this example, at the end of their training in memorizing the spaghetti snarled streets in London, literally have a measurably thicker brain, have more synapses, they have more connections between neurons, which means it's like building a muscle. They have a bigger muscle, in a sense. They have more capacity. In a part of the brain called the hippocampus that does visual spatial memory. In other words, they used it, so it got bigger. In the same way, people, for example, who have a mindfulness or meditation practice have thicker parts of the brain that control attention and are involved in self-awareness, which makes sense. Piano players have thicker parts of the brain that are involved in controlling fine motor motions, you know, of the small fingers of the hand. The famous thing from the Canadian psychologist Donald Hebb is neurons that fire together wire together. It's also true that if you don't use it, you lose it. That's the idea of what's called sometimes neural Darwinism, survival of the busiest. So the good news here is that if initially manually, and then over time automatically. You, number one, start disengaging attention. You stop feeding negative train thoughts and reaction cascades to other people who are you're frustrated by, irritated at, or worried about, etc. Then if you
repeat
that, those neural networks gradually wither away. In other words, if you are working or living with someone that says things and they kind of work you up, you know, it's like they turn your tail, get your knickers in a twist about the comment of that person. If you gradually help yourself to chill out sooner, drop the complaint, drop the case, move on, disengage from the relationship, whatever it is you do, crowd out those negative thoughts with more positive things like gratitude, or, you know, taking good care of yourself, or, you know, taking in the view that's coming from you from other people, then the neurons, the neural networks that support that negative reason will gradually wither some. And also, to what Conway was saying there, if you gradually rest the mind more and more on facts that are positive, small facts usually, but legitimate facts are positive, you will gradually build up those neural networks in a kind of mechanical process. You know, the brain at one level is a super complicated, extraordinary, amazing device, in a sense. It's a biological device. At a deeper level, though, honestly, it's kind of mechanical. It's like if you want to build a muscle in a gym, you know, you could lift 5 pounds twice and not get very much. You know what I mean? Or, alternately, you could lift 15 pounds 10 times, pause, and then do it 3 times more every day. And pretty soon, you're going to get a bigger muscle there. It's, you know, I've been a therapist a long time. It's made me more compassionate, but it's made me tougher because you got to earn it. You got to do the work. But if you do the work, you truly can have confidence that you, from the inside out, will be changing your own brain. You'll be reaching down inside the black box that's the core of your being and building it for the better. And that, for me, is very hopeful and good news.
It's interesting you say that, because the words I'm hearing you say, you have to do the work. You can't wish it. You got to do the work. And
yeah, that's right. Now, part of it is listening to people like you and thinking and so forth. That's part of the work. But, yeah, you got to do the work.
I'm touched also, Rick, by the notion of gratitude, someone can lift their spirits by writing down what it is they're grateful for, Rick. Why is that so powerful?
Well, interestingly, gratitude has been a hot area of research. Just like psychology has kind of shifted from focusing on our bad stuff with our mom or dad, you know, to more of these positive things like compassion or gratitude. Gratitude, for one, directs your attention to the good news in life. And the thing is, we have a brain that's biased toward looking for bad. We end up thinking that we're surrounded by a world that's continually at threat level orange. Yes, occasionally bad news occurs, and yes, we definitely need to look out for, you know, risk. All right. But we have a brain that's biased toward paper tiger paranoia, because most of the tigers, so-called, that we think are out there in our work, in our home, in ourselves, are actually more like paper tigers. So, you know, the challenge for us, of course, is to pull attention to the things that are good. That's number one, we're gratitude in. Number two, gratitude's positive emotion. Lots of research these days on the importance of positive emotion. It's not just the absence of the negative. It's not just pulling weeds that matters. You also plant flowers in the garden of your mind. You have to add in positive emotions and positive experience, and gratitude does that. Also, I think for a lot of people, what they're grateful for is often related to the others around them. And that speaks to the ways we evolved in very small bands of people. Exile in the Serengeti was a death sentence. So it's profoundly important to us at a physiological and neurological level, as well as a more mental level, to feel cared about, to feel included, to feel that at least there are people who have our back, you know, to whom we really matter, who really love us, who really care about us. And so when we're grateful, that tend to also often take us to that felt sense of being cared about and included, which is another positive of it.
Well said. Conway, what was your comment before I rudely interrupted you?
Well, in at my age, I've promptly forgotten, but Rick, you carried us through or showed us the trick, the brain. Is there another tool or another that one could use to sort of break the negative?
Anything that. So I've mentioned one so far, which is taking in the good. And as some of the things we take in, you know, gratitude is a very nice thing to take in, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so, and that's a method that people can use many times a day, including for, and this is an important point, including for the specific experiences that are their quote-unquote vitamin C. In other words, in life, there are certain kinds of experiences that are particularly healing for people. Speak about myself kind of quickly here. I was really young going through school. I had lots of feelings of being left out, excluded, you know, the little runny nerd guy, you know, always picked last for baseball, even though I'm pretty athletic, actually, as it turns out. And so now as an adult, I'm kind of vulnerable to feeling dismissed or excluded or seen as kind of lesser in group settings, even though it's not happening. So for me, it's been very important to really take in the good, my particular vitamin C, which is the experience of being seen and attuned to, empathized with, valued and included. All right? That's for me. For a different person, that may not have been their issue. Maybe their issue is around they felt they grew up in a very turbulent home environment or neighborhood, and they felt unsafe a lot and overwhelmed by these powerful forces pushing them around. So they, now in adulthood, really are served by taking in the good, in particular their vitamin C, of feelings of strength and safety, of protection, of having allies. Maybe a different person has been really frustrated in trying to achieve or accomplish things and has felt, in a way, helpless, like they're the cue ball, they're the eight ball, not the cue ball. And for them, then, in adulthood, their vitamin C is going to be feelings more like of efficacy. They can make things happen, you know, even in small ways, or simply inside their own mind, which, frankly, a major realm where we can generally make things happen. Or maybe a person has felt inadequate or, you know, not unworthy, ashamed in some ways. Maybe they were molested. Maybe other things happened that made them feel ashamed. There, too, it's important. Their vitamin D are going to be experiences more like of worth, of adequacy, of value, and so on. So those are examples. Okay, that's it on that method. A second thing to say is that it's very important to appreciate that the same machinery that evolved to get us away from a charging leopard or lethal aggression in a primate band, the same machinery is locked and loaded and fully operational in our bodies today if we encounter a frown across the dinner table or someone's face on Fox News or on MSNBC that we don't like, or, you know, a letter from the IRS or something, you know, that happens at work. And so, yes, we evolved capacities for short-term acute bursts of stress, but low-grade chronic stress is a killer. When everybody was dead by their 30th birthday in the Stone Age, it didn't matter. It was worth the trade-off, the short-term benefits of stress versus its long-term cost. But now, I'm 58 and a half, my dad's 92, he's got a new lady friend, you know, he's having a good time. And we want to live long and well. And so paying attention to the debilitating and toxic, pernicious effects of stress is important. Okay, how to do it? A key antidote for stress activation is what's called the parasympathetic nervous system. This is an important part of the nervous system that balances the fight-or-flight stress response, sympathetic nervous system. Most of us are in a state of chronic sympathetic arousal. We're pressed on time, we're rushing about, we're multitasking, we're frustrated about something, we're worried about something, we're annoyed about something. All that will activate the sympathetic nervous system and its related stress hormones like adrenaline and cortisol. Great for getting away from charging leopards. Really bad for long-term health and well-being, mental and physical. Okay, so we need the fire department to put out the fire of the sympathetic activation. We need the parasympathetic fire department. And there are a variety variety of ways people can activate it. I'll mention two right now that I like a lot that are kind of cool. One is to do three or more really long exhalations. The reason is that the parasympathetic wing of the nervous system handles exhaling. It's why the heart slows down slightly as we exhale. The sympathetic nervous system handles inhaling, which is why the heart speeds up a bit. So if you say inhale, people can do it right now if they like. They inhale on, let's say, a count of three, exhale for at least a count of six, and try to do three or so of those in a row. You will notice a dramatic impact, just three of those. If the needle on your 0 to 10 stress meter is hitting a 7 in some business meeting or rush hour traffic or dealing with some sibling squabble at home, just do three of those. It's going to move the needle down to a 4 or a 3 or a 2 probably. Okay, that's one method. Second method is to really relax the tongue. The reason is that the so-called rest and digest parasympathetic nervous system, as opposed to fight or flight, a sympathetic nervous system, well, digesting starts in the mouth. The mouth is full of parasympathetic nerve fibers. So if you relax a very fundamental part of the mouth, which is to say the tongue, you could all relax the jaw as well, but parasympathetic fibers are especially in the tongue, you will then send a message to it to wake up, you know, activate, and as it does that, it will put the fires out of sympathetic activation. And what I like to finish up here, like about these methods as well, is they're private. They're, you know, no one needs to know you're doing them, whether you're in a nightmare dinner with the in-laws or, you know, stuck at work in something. No one needs to know, right, you're doing them. So, all right, you want a third? I can give you a third one real fast if you want.
Give me a third one, method? Yeah. Then we're gonna go for a break.
Yeah, it goes to the thing I said earlier about the third one, the third benefit I could think of off the top of my head, gratitude. In other words, the felt sense of being cared about by others. One thing that people can do quite routinely is to bring to mind the sense of being with someone that you know cares about you. Could be someone in your life today or in your past. Could be a person. It could be a pet or an animal. It could even be a spiritual being. The relationship need not be perfect, right? But at least there's one major slice of the pie of that relationship in which you know this person has your back. They do care about you. Maybe they're annoying, you know, like mom or somebody or dad, but you know they love you. They really got your back. So you bring to mind the sense of that person, and then you let that become an experience. The whole point of this is not the concept. You cannot eat the menu. You have to eat the meal. It's not about the idea, it's about the experience, because that's what heals us. So you open up to, as you can, increasingly, the experience, the felt sense of being cared about, of mattering, of being, for example, liked, or perhaps respected, or perhaps even loved and cherished, right? And then you let yourself feel it, and ideally as well, take it in, you know, open to it, sense that it's sinking in, receive this beautiful experience, let it into you, all right? Just do that for 10 seconds. 5 seconds even, you'll notice it is immediately supported. One reason is that this fundamental experience of being included and heard about is very calming. So immediately it's turning down the heat of sympathetic stress-based activation, and it's building up the resource experience inside of positive emotion of being liked and being warm-hearted. And it's also giving you a sense that you matter, that you have worth. So you're getting tons of benefits from simply 5 to 10 seconds of feeling cared about.
This is great. And there's a double-edged sword I want to ask you about that particular question. And one is you can do all of these exercises. You can do rest your tongue and three or more exhales and feel cared about, but how do you tame that monkey mind that says, am I worthy? This is Sal with a fresh start. We're talking about light at the end of the tunnel today, on depression, on self-worth, on happiness, with my guest Rick Hansen and my husband Conway Felden. There's a lot more when we come back. Thank you.
7 to 13 fruits and vegetables every day? That's what the American Cancer Society tells us we should be eating. The problem is we either can't or won't. Juice Plus is not a vitamin supplement. It is whole food-based nutrition from 17 different fruits, vegetables, and grains. Juice Plus is based in science by third-party, primary, independent clinical research and published in peer-reviewed journals. The clinical research shows that it raises levels of antioxidants in the blood, enhances immune function, reduces DNA damage, and improves cardiovascular health. Juice Plus, the next best thing to fruits and vegetables. To order, call 617-688-3826. That's 617-688-3826. Or on the web at www.cknowltonjuiceplus.com. That's www.cknowltonjuiceplus.com.
Did you know that you can rate this show on iTunes? The show you're listening to right now. It's true. You can leave your thoughts about the show, the topic, the guest. You can even leave a suggestion. Then, before you leave, rate the show. The hosts love hearing from you, so next time you download this show from iTunes, leave your thoughts and rate the show for the host and for others.
Are you always on the go? Follow Contact Talk Radio on Twitter for up-to-the-second updates on what's happening live on the air and around the Contact Talk Radio world. Get updates from the station, the hosts, as well as information on upcoming programs and schedule changes. Follow us on Twitter at www.twitter.com/CTR Network. Don't miss out on anything that's happening on Contact Talk Radio. That's twitter.com/CTR Network.
Are you a small business owner? Have you felt like you're juggling, trying to keep all the balls in the air at once? Unorganized, overworked, stretched, lost that motivation? Well, there's a solution, and it can be as easy as having someone in your arena to support you as you redefine and strategize your vision. See how others have found having a coach moves their small businesses forward in a more productive and positive direction. The consultation is free. Contact Sally Felton at 978-626-0090 or on the web at sallyfeltonlifecoach.com. And let's get you started. What would it feel like to see your business grow?
Welcome back with Sally Felton and Conway Felton, Fresh Start and Light at the End of the Tunnel. That's the show today. My guest is Rick Hansen, and he is the author of Buddha's Brain. And Buddha's Brain, if you don't know about it, it's the practical neuroscience of happiness, love, and wisdom, and is definitely on the bestseller list. I have to tell you that during our break, Conway and Rick and I were talking about self-worth, how you value yourself, which is self-worth, but when does it get in the way? When does your monkey mind take over and say, you know, am I really worth it? I mean, do I have value? I have so much self-doubt. And Conway was great in being very brave and very forthright in saying, you know, Rick, I have been feeling this way more so this past spring and in the past year than I ever have. So, Conway and Rick, take it away. Let's talk about what happens when you start to self-doubt and that dialogue and pushing back and trying to be positive gets in the way.
Right.
Well, to set the stage a little bit, for me, it's not crushing. I know it's there. It's a bit of a, no question, it's a bit of a wet blanket. It takes additional strength to push back, and it can be tiring. And I'm not equating to, you know, it was a long winter in New England, but I understand, cloudy days and gloom and low pressure and stuff like that. But it's, with the arrival of spring, we hope, and some summer finally in New England, I'm looking for a little lift. And it doesn't seem to be happening, and it's self-doubt. It's not feeling worthy. You know, I know it's the ancillary, or comes in the package, if you will, with depression from time to time. And I know, you know, as my days and weeks go by, I go up and down a little bit, just like the swells in the ocean. Nothing too high, nothing too low. So this one's dragging a little, and I'm getting, you know, I'm not exasperated or totally frustrated with it, but I'm looking to, it's okay, this is enough. I feel like it's time to go to work. I want to break this. I want to get sort of free of the quicksand that might be up to my knees or so, and get up on the land and start running with more positive, attitudes. So any tricks of the trade or comments you have, Rick, that'd be great.
Sure. Well, okay, a couple things here. First, you know, there's an important distinction between what people can do through the kind of general self-help practices I've spoken of so far, and what it really takes to deal with an underlying, let's say, significant amount of perhaps anxiety in a person's case, perhaps shame in a person's case, perhaps low self-worth or depression in a person's case. So I want to be clear about that. On the other hand, the kind of general practices that I write about in my book, they're very important for people to do, because what they do in general is it's not so much that they're devoted for an acute situation, but they gradually improve your overall level of functioning. So that, and gradually do tend to draw your mind and your feelings away from anxiety or depression or low self-worth or self-doubt, and draw you to a better place. Okay, now, more specifically, I'll tell you a couple of things in particular. One is, I think sometimes it's appropriate to really open up in a very mindful way. That's where the mindfulness skills come in, where you step back from what Sally called the monkey mind of self-doubt. You step back from it. It's there. It doesn't go away. But you're suddenly now 30 rows back at the movie theater watching it on the screen instead of being glued to the screen yourself. So you're sitting back and going, wow, a lot of self-doubt, and you explore, what's this about? What part is based in ideas? What part is an underlying quality of feeling and emotion? What part, frankly, links to previous experiences in my life, maybe even going all the way back into childhood, even early childhood? What is this about? That alone often will give people relief, and it always gives you information, and it always strengthens your capacity for mindfulness itself, because neurons that fire together wire together, including the neurons, in a sense, involved in mindfulness. So that's one. Two, sometimes you get an insight. You realize that this self-doubt is about something, and maybe it's about something you're not handling in your life, or maybe it's truly just about some bit of unfinished business from your first real job or your first real marriage or your first real childhood, whatever. And you realize with insight, that's what that self-doubt's about. You know, for me, I'll tell you a little breakthrough I had in my 20s about something like this. I realized that going through school, I had been a nerd, not a wimp, right? That's a big insight for our people, especially I think for men. They had to realize that I'd been a nerd, but not a wussy. I had not been a wimp at all. And sometimes you get an insight. So that's another. Third thing, sometimes in a weird way, Conway, and those who are listening, the internal weather, if you will, of the mind that could kind of seems dark and overcast and gloomy for no good reason, frankly, sometimes it's purely physiological. That does not mean necessarily that you've got to run to a psychiatrist for an antidepressant, but it could mean that there's something a little off physiologically. For example, if you think of all the health problems in the physician's book, the one symptom that shows up more commonly than any other is depressed mood. It's the first sign that something's not quite right in the body physiologically. I don't mean that there's an illness or a bad thing, but something's not quite right often. I'm not saying that's the case here, but it could be. So to me, it's always worth just double-checking. My mental checklist. Am I doing my exercise? Am I still eating well? Am I not drinking too much? Am I getting enough sleep? Am I making sure I'm not allergic to something? Sometimes, I mean, there's a whole field called psychoneuroimmunology, and if we have any kind of allergic reaction, in other words, we have any kind of immune system activation, that's going to drag down the nervous system. Because in evolution, it made sense when animals were sick or wounded to make them depressed. So they would go hunker down under some bushes, and even though they felt like crap, they did not at least go out into the world and risk getting eaten or killed, right? So I would double-check that. And that includes, frankly, making sure you're taking lots of good vitamins and taking the nutrients that have research-proven benefits for mood, like essential fatty acids, that's good fish oil, a complex, because B vitamins are important for converting amino acids like tryptophan to neurotransmitters like serotonin, which are the target of antidepressants. And if you want, and this is in the appendix of our book, it's all based on research studies, you could explore, if you wanted, supplementing either tryptophan or 5-hydroxytryptophan, which you can typically get at a health food store. Don't do this if you're already taking a psychotropic medication like an antidepressant, you know, without talking with somebody at least. But on your own, if you want to experiment, start at a low dose, always be careful. You know, start super low, gradually go up. The body knows what to do with these molecules. They're natural, so you don't get side effects so much. If you start feeling a little too torpid, you know, a little too sleepy, a little too, you know, lethargic, dial back. That's about the only side effect, really, that happens from boosting serotonin and within careful, you know, normal ranges. You could experiment with that.
Right.
So that would be my next main suggestion. And then I think the third one I would just finish up on here as a go-to is honestly, sometimes we need bigger problems. We need to vitalize ourselves by putting ourselves in a bigger sandbox. That some of what is happening is we're walking around in a suit of armor that's three sizes too small, and we need to play a bigger game. You know, we need to get more out. We need to play bigger, faster, looser, take more chances, swing out, strike out more, but hit more home runs. You know, other analogies come to mind. Anyway, that's the last thing I'll say that sometimes can be helpful for people. And also,
what I find
really, 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 really take in good of positive experiences, because the building blocks of positive emotion are the internalization of positive experiences.
What is the, just to let you know, Rick, what is the toughest time of day for me? It's early in the morning, or not so early. Luckily, I'm sleeping pretty well. But when I first wake up, the thing that floods in the doors is most often it's got a negative color to it. And the worry switch goes on, and the needle gets in the red zone. And I catastrophize, it caves in a little bit. Am I paralyzed? Am I, you know, frozen? I can't even get out of bed. No, I can get up, and it's true, once I get up and start moving, and I always have sort of a sketch out of what I want to do during the day, and once I start moving around for an hour or two, the anxiety level starts to go down and all but evaporate. But certainly it's always, you know, early morning with the worry factor. And as I get going, the worry, you know, that it does evaporate, thank God. Or if it's a fog, you know, from an analogy point of view, it's a foggy morning, and as soon as the sun comes out, it burns off. But the self-doubt issue, it doesn't haunt me all day long. You know, I'm aware that when it creeps in, I've now sort of decided I'm going to let it creep in. In other words, I'm not going to use up all my energy fighting it. I'm going to let it come in. I'm going to carry it with me on a backpack, and I'm going to try to deal with it, so to speak. And that's worked pretty well. You know, I'm not demanding that it go away in the next 2 seconds because I feel that can be unrealistic. The other thing I work on is perfection. One of the most difficult things is setting yourself up to, I call it setting yourself up to fail. And what I mean by that is, you can, I can have a day that's, all right, I've got this list of 20 things in front of me. There's no way I'm going to get through them all. So that's,
right,
you know, I could get
right.
through the first 10, and I will look back at that and say, you failed. And I give no value for maybe some of those that I did, you know, did really well. So I've learned not to have, goals that, should I not attain them, that I turn around and beat myself up. I've gotten more flexible insofar as say, well, if you get it done, great, value what you did. If you did a good job at it, try to let that seep into your system, but don't be overcritical. But it's work. You know, as Sally said earlier, you got to do the work. And that is so true. And so, you know, my project is related on sort of this self-doubt and self-worth component and realizing
I
got to do the work.
I'd give you a couple of suggestions if I could. Yeah.
Sure. Please.
Well, yeah. And I'll make them, because I think they have general interest.
Yeah.
And, of course, I appreciate how candid you're being. Well, first suggestion would be, first of all, what you're describing is quite normal, actually. People talk, it's a clinical question. In other words, when is anxiety more prominent? And for many, many people, it's more prominent upon waking. That's what they talk about. And they say exactly what you're saying, Conway. As they get moving and get mobilized, the intensity of it fades, but there is a kind of a haunting or a shadow that it casts over the whole day that they wish were not present. So it's normal. First off, one thing you can do is, again, a lot what you're doing is really practice that mindfulness of not, how can I put it, of being observing it, but not buying into it. Of seeing it more like an impersonal, unpleasant, arbitrary phenomenon, kind of like raining on a Sunday picnic. It's a drag, but it's not me. It's just the rain. You know, it's just the thunderclouds. So it's not me, Conway. It's just a sensation in my body. What is anxiety, actually? You know, it's some thoughts passing away in my mind, like clouds moving across the sky. It's just sensations in my body also passing away through awareness, like clouds in the sky. But awareness, which holds these experiences, is detached from them and is not harmed by these sensations or thoughts or emotions moving through awareness. So that would be my first suggestion. And that's why it's really important. Mindfulness is a foundational skill. I have two chapters on basically mindfulness and attention, including how to really deepen concentration if people are interested in prayer or meditation in a deep way. But getting control, you know, attention is like a combination spotlight and vacuum cleaner. It illuminates what it rests upon and then sucks it into your brain because neurons that fire together wire together. What we pay attention to super turbocharges neuronal activity. So getting control of that spotlight is very important. That's why I devote so much time to it. Second suggestion I have, just before sleep, maybe you're already doing these things, by the way, but just before sleep, really set yourself up by taking in the good, taking 5-10 minutes just before sleep to kind of marinate in well-being. And since we're talking here about anxiety and inadequacy, really calling into yourself experiences of safety, of strength, of being cared about, and of worth. Those four things are the experiential antidotes. They're the vitamin C's to the particular scurvy, as it were, that we're talking about here. And so I would do that. And then additionally, this is a neuro-linguistic programming technique, or NLP, called future pacing. Just before falling asleep, now that you're grounded and you've really marinated in these four key experiences and you're still in them, imagine a clock that's moving quickly next to Conway sleeping.
and he's smiling while he sleeps. The clock is moving quickly. And you're seeing Conway continuing to marinate in these key positive experiences throughout the night. And then you're even seeing the clock keep moving into his waking time, when you normally awake, whatever that is, and even for a couple, and for 2 to 3 hours afterward, and you're seeing yourself and you're feeling, it's like anticipation, like emotional anticipation. You're anticipating the feelings of confidence, safety, of being cared about, and being of worth, you know, going forward through your waking and into your day. Okay? The third thing I would suggest,
yep,
is, if you want, check your cortisol. Cortisol is a stress hormone. It has a normal rising and falling. The when it rises, you might be getting it rising too soon for you. And cortisol is a stress hormone, will associate quickly to other neural networks and neurophysiological phenomena that will tend to key you into anxiety. Okay, you were going to say
how
something?
How do you check your cortisol level?
Yeah, you want to talk to a physician or someone who has access to these tests. Typically, there are methods that involve just saliva. They're really simple, and they track your cortisol over a 24-hour period and compare that to good norms. Typically, I think it's worth going after someone with a medical license who also is sort of open-minded and calm about complementary and alternative medicine. You know, it's like the two pitfalls.
Yeah.
One pitfall is to be like, hey, granola is going to cure my cancer. Okay, we don't want to go there, right? Vitamin C, you know, cures all ills. Chiropractic adjustments cure cancer. We don't want to go there. On the other hand, the tradition in medicine is to be incredibly resistant to innovation, partly because they want to be careful and, you know, they also, medical school makes them think they have godlike powers or something like that. So medicine has a long history of really resisting innovation, including what's been worthy about things like chiropractic and nutritional medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to fall there. You want to be down the middle of someone who's sane, who's rational, has their feet firmly on the ground, but is truly open to evidence, because that's all I'm talking about here. There's a lot of evidence that if your cortisol is rising quickly, it can disturb your sleep and be a factor in anxiety in the morning. Okay?
Got it. I loved your analogy of, yeah, that is a good tip. Raining on a picnic, when you mentioned that, that struck home. That analogy, I went, that is good application.
Yeah,
for
it's
a typical
bummer,
male who looks for...
Right.
You know,
it's
for,
a bummer,
for
but
males,
it's not
that look for logic. Yep.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm. Those
you
are very helpful.
Well, what I'm struck with is when we talked at the very beginning, in order to do this, in order to help ourselves, we can read all the self-help books we want. We can read Buddha's Brain until we're blue in the face. We could buy 15 copies of it, but unless we start to do the work, nothing's going to change, Rick. And I think that is what I'm trying to get through, is we need to be able to risk taking one step forward. And if any of these tips that, I've been writing notes like crazy, but...
Yeah.
For example, we talked about, well, let's trick the brain. Let's trick the brain to start to get rid of these negative emotions by listing 10 positive thoughts. Taking in the good was another thing you said. And also, specific experiences that are healing. Be seen, be valued, feel included. Another great one you talked about was for anxiety or stress, rest the tongue. Take three or more exhales. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Also practicing, as I said, mindfulness, you know. And by the way, it's really interesting. The very first concrete suggestion I gave in the first chapter of my book was to get on your own side. And so that you would take action. I agree with you entirely. motivation is the silver bullet, you know, it's the key. And that's why one thing I also suggest for people is to, you know, have self-compassion. Self-compassion really helps us take action. Because you know what I mean? If we don't care about our pain, I see people routinely where I care more about their pain, I'm sure you do too, Sally, than they care about their own pain, right? Their own suffering, their own discontent,
their own
lack of fulfillment. Yeah, exactly. So when you bring compassion to yourself, in other words, you bring the same attitude of goodwill and the wish that someone not suffer and sort of a sympathetic feeling, if you just bring that to yourself, not wallowing in self-pity, it's giving yourself the same attitude you would give to a dear friend who had your life, right? If you do that, it, you know, for 10, 20, 30 seconds in a row, that's about all it is, half a minute. You just do that for about half a minute, it really makes you, research again has shown, this is another hot area of research, it makes you more resilient, it makes you tougher, more able to deal with the tough things in life, and it also lifts mood, it brings good energy, and helps you, you know, get up, get off your butt, or get out of the, you know, the rut you're in, and then start taking those little actions you talked about, Sally, to make your life better and make this world a better place.
Where can they get your book besides through your website? And your website is www.buddhasbrain.com. Where can they get this?
Well, the book's everywhere. It has done very well. It's certainly over a year and a half out. It's still doing really well. Amazon, obviously, barnesandnoble.com. Also, I would say about my website, it's chock full of free resources. That's my orientation. I have a Buddhist background, and you know, Buddhism is no monopoly on generosity, but it's been a big influence for me. Anyway, my website's full of free resources, the PowerPoint slide sets from tons of workshops I've given, including for therapists, as well as very accessible talks, interviews, video presentations, articles, and so forth. It's all very freely available, and people can go there. Plus, I also link people to other good resources that are in this kind of emerging field of how can you practically and effective in the trenches, you know, in real life ways, actually change your brain for the better over time.
And I have to tell you, Rick, that I have certainly signed up probably a year and a half ago for your weekly e-newsletter, Just One Thing. I tell you,
you
write so beautifully, and there are always aha moments that I take away, and I just wanted to share that because that is just a wonderful resource for people. Mm. It really is.
Well, I appreciate that. At this point, 21,000 people net, over 21,000 actually, subscribe to it, and it's free. There's no, you know, and you can always unsubscribe. I'm very respectful of privacy. I never share email addresses with anybody. So if people are interested also in checking that out, they can find out about it on the front page of my website, the Just One Thing. It's a little practice. Each week it's a new practice. And
it is.
You know, they range from things, like notice you're all right now. That's a good practice. For you too, Conway. Notice you're actually all right. Even though the brain is whispering to you, look out,
you're right.
Level orange, tiger. Yeah. The truth is, it's lying to you. You know, there's a term in psychology called signal anxiety. You know, the brain produces this ongoing little trickle of anxiety to keep us, you know, looking over our shoulders. But the truth is, that signal anxiety is usually just noise. It's meaningless.
Yeah.
That's a way to really, again, when you hold this with mindful awareness, you realize those clouds are meaningless. It's meaningless. It's a drag, but it's meaningless that it rained on your picnic.
Yep, exactly.
So thank you. That's an example of one of the Just One Thing. Yeah,
my hardware, or most people, everybody's hardware is just fine. It's the software.
Yeah. Exactly.
You know, you have the capacity.
Conway, we've got to stop right now. Again, our hardware is just fine. It's just the rewiring that needs to be fixed. My guest today, Conway Felton and Rick Hansen, the author of Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. Best to you all. We'll be back next week.
Thank you. Goodbye.